started. It's a moment or two after nine, and while there are one or two people coming this direction on the hill, but we'll start. I forgot to introduce myself yesterday, so if you're listening to this yesterday, oh, wait a minute, that doesn't quite work. These tapes are not retroactive. My name is Fred Niedner from Valparaiso, Indiana, where I teach Bible in a theology department at Valparaiso University, and I have been coming up to Holden for some years now and inflicting my brand of biblical theology on unsuspecting Lutherans and others who come up here. The series I've been doing has to do with promises of God and how promises from very early in the biblical tradition play out in one way or another, all the way into the theology and practices that we read about in the New Testament. So every day of my series is almost one of these crazy things that goes from Genesis to Revelation. And you should never trust anybody that goes from Genesis to Revelation in 1 hour. So you are forewarned. The alleged hilarity for the day could have been in the title. I could have used that old saw today for this session, given what we're going to do. How odd of God to choose the Jews. But since we're going to be talking a lot about names and how promises have to do with name, God promises Israel in the text we start with today that God will give a great name to this people. I thought I would wear my hilarity, and so it's a little cold just to wear it all by itself. But this is you can get these things from the Fred Society on the web. I have a FedEx shirt that in this case is FredEx. You can buy bumper stickers that say things like better Fred than dead. People of my generation get. But, names. We'll talk a lot about names. Because a name is a reputation. And what we're really talking about today is God's reputation. That's what's at stake in the promises we discussed today. Starting with Genesis 12, verses 1 to 3, which is one of the most fundamental of all the promises anywhere in the scriptural tradition. It's foundational for many things, as we shall see. This is the call of Abram and Sarai to leave behind the land of their ancestors and to go to a new place for a purpose that only God at the moment can imagine. Now the Lord said to Abram, "Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." So this is the key text for Israel's election, their chosenness, their place in history as God's people, which is still today an issue among believing people in the Jewish and Christian traditions and extending out even to certain other traditions. Even Islam, in one way or another, needs to pay attention to this. To this thinking. In the New Testament, it's critical. The promises I read, if you were here at the beginning of the series on Monday, always harken back to this, because it is believing this promise that makes Abram the great paragon of faith and the ancestor of all who are faithful in the way that the Bible understands faithfulness. So we read in Romans 4, for example, no distrust, pardon me, made Abram waver concerning the promise of God, but he grew strong in his faith as he gave glory to God, and so forth. Or Acts 7. Then Abram left the country of the Chaldeans and settled in Haran. After his father died, God had him move from there to this country in which you are now living. He did not give him any of it as a heritage, not even a foot's length, but promised to give it to him as his possession and to his descendants after him, even though he had no child. So even in the New Testament times, as we'll see, this text and Abram's faithfulness exemplified here is important. Hebrews 11, in the great catalog of those who are faithful, lists Abram. By faith, Abram obeyed when he was called to set out for a place that he was to receive as an inheritance, and he set out not knowing where he was going. So, that's enough on this as a central promise. Hopefully that's clear. The promise includes descendants. I will make of you a great nation. It includes a great name, whatever that may be. We'll talk about that. So, descendants, name. It includes this vague notion of blessing. I will bless you. That's a promise. But exactly what it means to be blessed is not defined. That'll have to be defined somehow later. And you will be a blessing. Not just a blessing generally, but a blessing to all the families of the earth. What could that mean? What can it mean to be a blessing to all the families of the earth? That will make their life better? But if so, how? Monetarily? And if so, would that be enough? I mean, if you read the stories, as we'll see shortly, there are times that being involved with the seed of Abram makes you richer, but there are also times it makes you poorer. So we'll have to try to figure out a little bit, anyway, of what it means to be a blessing to all the families of the earth. But first, we have to review a little bit of what we did yesterday, because a lot of you weren't here. This piece is also part of a pattern group of stories, as was the flood story that we looked at yesterday. I described yesterday how all the stories beginning with Genesis 3 have the same pattern. In Genesis 3, the story that we often call the fall, we have the first human beings defying God and stealing from the tree that God said you can't eat from. And we call that, just for shorthand, a sin. And in the second place, God discovers what they've done. And in the third place, God curses not the people right away, but God curses the serpent, God curses the ground, God curses everything around the people so that their life will be difficult. And then fourth, what I call keeping the show on the road, or in short, a provisional solution to take care of the terrible things that human beings have unleashed upon themselves and into the world by virtue of their mistake. In the case of Genesis 3, the thing that they unleash is shame. Their eyes were opened and they recognized that they were naked. That's a very complicated and fun thing to look at, but we don't have time today. We have to march all the way to Revelation. Well, almost. We'll get as far as Romans. But what are we going to do about shame? We can't just let them live forever in those stupid fig leaves. So God makes garments of skin, covers their shame with something of God's own making, so that life can continue despite what's happened. In the next story, same outline, Cain kills his brother in a fit of anger at God, but he can't get at God, so he gets at the next best thing. He gets at God's pet. God comes around and discovers something missing. Where is your brother? I hear his blood crying from the ground. What has happened? God curses Cain's relationship to the land so that he will be forever wanderer. But now there's a problem unleashed in the world that is even worse than shame. It's vengeance. And what are we going to do about the thirst for vengeance? We can't have everybody killing Cain. And then killing those who killed Cain. And then killing those who killed those who killed Cain. And on and on and on. And so God puts a mark on Cain and says, sorry folks, vengeance belongs to me. No vengeance killing. That's my job. We got to keep the show on the road. If I let you go that way, you'll all be dead. Then we get the flood story. We have all this corruption going on at the beginning, which God observes and grieves over and curses by means of a flood, but saves one family. To keep the show on the road. Try to start over. And then the burden of yesterday's session, at least in part, was God's recognition that at the end of the third time, and having cursed as thoroughly as you can possibly curse without quitting on the whole project, God recognizes in Genesis 9, or at the end of Genesis 8 actually, it doesn't work. You can curse all you want, and it fixes nothing. And you just have to keep cleaning up after these people. And so that's what God is stuck with. So God swears at the end of Genesis 8 and into the beginning of 9 with the covenant and the rainbow that God will never do that again. That will never again be the solution. But what's the alternative? Then you get a bunch of begats after Noah proves God was right, and we have a sort of a repeat of the fall story with planting a garden, eating, or as I said yesterday, drinking from the fruits thereof, and you get nakedness and shame and cursing and everything all over again. We're right back where we started in one generation. And then we get some begats from all the people that come from Noah. And the Tower of Babel story. The people have one language, and they are one people, and they decide if we don't do something to make ourselves totally united and make our own name and make ourselves a name, we will be scattered. So let's build a tower into the heavens. In other words, let's take over. Let's storm the heavens and take control. God comes down in Genesis 11, it says, and looks at all this and says to whoever God consults with about things like this, would you look at that? They got one language and they're one people. There's nothing they won't try. Let's go down and confuse their language. Can you hear God chuckling? God can start to imagine the chaos. So that is some kind of curse. It's not put in the language of curse, but it's breakage. It breaks language. It makes people unintelligible to each other. You know, and theologians love to debate about whether this is actually a good thing or a bad thing, because nowadays we love pluralism, and we have reason to love pluralism, because difference enriches. You know, if you know anything about languages, you know that there is riches to be had in learning languages that are not your own. Because there are things you can say in another language that you wouldn't even dream existed in your own. I mean, the other day, for one of my kids, I was trying to explain Schadenfreude. Mm-hmm. You know, do most of you know what Schadenfreude is? A German word. See here, this is an illustration. You know, Schadenfreude is just a perfect word. everybody else screws up, and you just keep waiting for them to screw up. You know, it's literally, it's rejoicing over somebody else's fault. But you don't have to explain all that. In German, you can just say, Schadenfreude. There's no English word for it. There's paragraphs in which you try to explain this. So every language has this stuff. And in some languages, you can actually see reality in a whole different way. As I love to say about Hebrew, for example, a language that has no tenses. And what does it mean to live in a world where you don't think about time in the way that we think about time? Stuff's either happening or it isn't. That's a different way to live in the world. So there's riches to this. On the other hand, we can't understand each other, and we end up isolating ourselves from each other, hanging out only with our own kind that we can understand, and pretty soon we're hating each other because you're different and we don't understand each other and we don't want your stupid riches of your stupid language. So by the end of the story in Genesis 11, we find ourselves in the world that we live in. This is the reality that we know. A world of scattered people who can't understand each other. But there's one thing missing in the pattern at the end of Genesis 11, and that is, what are we going to do about this now? What's the hedge against the world ending because of the logical conclusions of all this brokenness and division? Answer, Genesis 12, 1 to 3. We can't let curse reign anymore. In fact, you know, maybe this isn't really curse. Maybe this is a kind of a provisional solution of some kind, splitting it up so that you can't take over and storm the heavens. But we can't ever let that be the last word anymore because we know that doesn't work. So instead of curse, we have its opposite in Hebrew, which is blessing. Blessing has to be worked instead of curse. And so Genesis 12, 1 to 3 is the spot in which God shifts away from using curse as a solution to anything, and the alternate solution is blessing. God picks a people to work blessing in the world instead of curse. And the way I like to describe this is, two things here need to be said. This is what you tell the children when the children of Israel ask around the campfire, you know, who are we? What is the meaning of being our people? Well, we are God's agents of blessing in the world. This is who we are. And here's the story of how God chose us and why God had to choose somebody. But the I don't mean that that's not big, but theologically, the really big thing that God risks here is, if you think about it, this is God's last hope for the world. God has tried all kinds of things to try to deal with the brokenness of humankind. One punishment, one provisional solution after another, and the train wreck keeps getting worse. The alternative is to do blessing instead of curse. And if that doesn't work, then what? If blessing fails, I mean, we just quit. We do the flood but save nobody or something. Because if we already know curse doesn't work, this is it. So, one way to understand the whole rest of what happens in the Hebrew Bible is the relationship between God and this people who are God's last hope. And that gives the two of them an amazingly tight relationship, and each must cling to the other with a tenacity that's, you know, the stakes are life and death. I'll say later, it's like marriage. These two are stuck with each other, and they've got to make it, because neither one is anything or can make it without the other. I'll talk more about that later. So God pins God's hopes for this world on flesh and blood people. And already here is a form of incarnation of God's work in the world. Well, this promise gets tested. Abram tries to save his own hide twice by giving away Sarah, because she is, after all, his half-sister, and it's convenient a couple of times because people think she's pretty good-looking and they might kill him to get her. He says, oh, well, she's my sister, help yourself. So she moves into first Pharaoh's harem and then into Abimelech's household, and both times, you know, and these two stories are very complex and we're just going to spend a lot of time on them. But, you know, you're not going to become a great nation if you keep giving your wife away into somebody else's household. So God keeps having to fix that. Then there's the problem of Sarah being barren, as the text reads. It's hard to become a great nation when that's going on. And so Abram is understandably frustrated and worried that this might not work. And Genesis 15 is a place worth stopping for a moment. I talked the other day about how one word for promise in the Old Testament are promises called covenants, or as they were known then, if they spoke Latin, they would have called them this, testaments. Because what you did to symbolize your promise was two guys stood face to face and put their hands underneath each other's thighs and made a testament. Well, how do you get God to do that? How do you stand face to face with God so that God has some at stakeness? Genesis 15. After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Do not be afraid, Abram, I'm your shield. Your reward shall be very great. Abram said, Lord God, what will you give me? I continue childless, and the heir of my house is going to be Eliezer of Damascus? Abram said, you've given me no offspring, so a slave born in my house will be my heir. The word of the Lord came to him, no, this man shall not be your heir. No one but your very own issue shall be your heir. So he brought him outside and said, look toward heaven, count the stars, if you're able to count them. So shall your descendants be. And Abraham believed. And the Lord reckoned it to him as righteousness, which we won't take time to talk about. But then, here's the ceremony of that statement. Here's why in Hebrew you don't make a covenant or fashion a covenant or something like that. You cut a covenant. The word for making covenants in Hebrew is always to cut a covenant. Here's why. Break verse 9. He said to Abram, bring me a heifer 3 years old and a female goat 3 years old and a ram 3 years old, a turtle dove and a young pigeon. And he brought all these and he cut them in two lengthways, laying each half over against the other. But he didn't cut the birds in two. When the birds of prey came down on the carcasses, Abram drove them away. And as the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and a terrifying darkness. And the Lord said, know this for certain, that your offspring shall be aliens in a land not their own. They'll be oppressed for 400 years. I'll bring judgment on the nations they serve. They shall come out with great possessions. As for you, you shall go to your ancestors in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age, and they'll come back here in the fourth generation. So a whole rehearsal of Israel's history. And then when the sun had gone down and it was dark, a smoking fire pot and a flaming torch passed between the pieces, that is, of the animals that had been cut in half. And on that day the Lord cut a covenant with Abram, saying, to your descendants I give this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates, and so forth and so forth. And there's all that land that's given to them, which we'll talk about later. Now that may not look like much to you, but what's going on there is God has made an old-fashioned covenant of the kind that you cut by means of animals. You take precious animals and cut them in half. And then if you're not God and have to do it by means of a smoking fire pot, the two of you walk between the two halves of the animal, and you promise to each other, if I break my promise, you may cut me in half in the way we have cut these animals. That's what God has done in this story. God has told Abram, you don't trust me? Okay, let's cut a covenant. You may cut me in half. That's what God does by means of this vision today. Now, exactly how you get a hold of God to cut God in half, I'm not sure what we're supposed to envision. Of course, Christians with the theology of the cross, we have a way to think about that. But this is what, you know, this is how far God is willing to go with Abram. This is, you know, God swearing by God's own life, I will be faithful to you, Abram. So this is a vision of at-stakeness for God. Well, eventually, of course, Abram begets both Ishmael and Isaac, and he will have countless offspring, innumerable as the stars that God invited Abram to try to count. And so the promise of descendants is clear. Gradually we'll see how the promise of name gets worked out. But what does it possibly mean to be a blessing to all the families of the earth? I've talked about this many times up here at Holden. It seems I always end up talking about Genesis up here. But if you would ask over the long term in the Jewish community, what is the great blessing that Judaism gives to all the families of the earth, among other things, probably and most importantly, it's Torah. Torah is the great gift. And, you know, we're still, in our own culture, taking pieces of Torah and posting it on the courthouse, and then fighting about whether we really should do this. But that's what it is, you know? The Ten Commandments, and a whole bunch of stuff. You know, Torah is everywhere, still. It's still a blessing to all the families of the earth. That's one way to envision it. Christians would say it's the Messiah that we find in Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. And there is the blessing for all the families of the earth. But in the text of Genesis, there may be some other things as well as stuff like this that this text doesn't yet completely envision. One of the things clearly that is a blessing of the presence of God's people is when they are living in integrity with other people prosper. When they don't live in integrity amongst other people suffer. So that's clear from the Genesis stories. When Abram swears, when Abram passes off Sarah as his sister, every time it makes other people suffer, not just him. Pharaoh suffers, Abimelech suffers. So wherever there's lack of integrity on Abram's part, everyone suffers, not just him. When he lives honestly and with integrity, trusting in the promise, other people thrive as well. So that may be a picture of what it means. I have my own little theory that you can see some of the blessings that this people is to bring to the earth in the names of the great ones, because the names all are given to us with great ceremony and stories of their significance. So just quickly, because we don't want to dwell on this too long, the first child who becomes the child of promise of this people is Isaac. And do you remember what Isaac means? Laughter. And why is that child to be named? I'd love to explain this. In Hebrew, it's Yitzhak. And it's onomatopoeia. Yitzhak. It's the sound of laughter, kind of guttural laughter. Yitzhak. But for what laughter is Isaac named?
When Sarah laughed.
When did she laugh?
When she heard she was going to have a baby over 90.
Okay. Yeah, that's another feature we don't have time to talk about. What was with the Egyptians lusting after this woman? This has to do with some editing issues. But in any case, Sarah laughed at the promise that she was going to have child, and so did Abram. There's another lesser known story in which Abram laughs at the promise too. And we all think, sort of knee-jerk, well, that's the laughter for which this child is named, because there was so much laughter about whether this is ever going to work. But that's not the laughter for which this child is named. In Genesis 21, we're not going to take time to stop and read it in detail, but Genesis 21, 1-7 is the story of Isaac's birth. And what happens when Isaac is finally born after all this waiting and waiting and waiting and all the other shenanigans that went into trying to get a kid for this couple, including the whole Hagar deal. Sarah, when this child is born, says, oh, now everyone is going to laugh with me because God has seen my plight and given me this child. So the child is not named for laughter at the promise, but named for laughter with each other over having received blessing. And that's important to remember, I think, because there's an enormous difference between laughter at and laughter with. And if we could only learn to laugh with instead of laugh at, there could be a kind of blessing for all the families of the earth. Next generation is Jacob. He becomes the child of promise. His name means he'll get you. He'll cheat you. It actually comes from when he's born and he tries to pull his brother back. His brother comes out first and he wants to be first. And so he tries to pull his brother back, but he doesn't quite make it. Brother gets out first, and he spends his whole life trying to get ahead of that brother. And his name means he'll supplant you. And that's what it most literally means. He'll finally best you. He'll get you in the end. That's what Yahako means. Well, toward the end of the story of what we know about Jacob's younger life, you know, he has to flee from his brother, and then he's finally, after he's become a great people with wives and maidservants by whom he's got a lot of children and so forth, he's going to go back and he's going to try to face his brother, but he's scared. So good old Jacob, he sends the women and children ahead across the river Jabbok. It doesn't say to see what would happen, but we can sort of think that. He stays back. He spends the night pondering what the next day will bring. And then comes that famous scene in which he suddenly finds himself wrestling the night stranger. All night, he wrestles this person. And finally, finally he says, let me go. The night stranger says, let me go. Daylight's coming. And Jacob says, I will not let you go until you bless me. And the night stranger says, what I'm going to give you is a new name. I'm also going to whack you in the hip so you can never walk the same, so remember this deal. But your name from now on is not Yaakov, but Israel, the one who fights with God, because you have fought with God and lived. And the next day, he goes across the river, and he meets up with his brother, and instead of whacking him and smiting him and all the other stuff that Jacob thought Esau might do, Esau falls all over him and kisses him and cries on him and says, I'm so glad to see you, little brother. Where have you been? All along, his fight was with God, not his brother. And that's what he needed to learn. And if only everybody else could learn that your real battle is with God, not with your brother or your sister or your wife or your husband or your kids, or whoever, if you could learn that your real battle is with God, it'd be a lot, we'd be a lot easier on each other. If only Cain could have known that, that he could never fix his fight with God by killing his brother. So there's a really deep thing about the human condition in this name change. That would be a blessing to all the families of the earth if we could really know that that's where our big battle was. The last child, and you know, I've done whole sessions up here on this story. The next child of promise is Judah, who is the fourth child in line. Jacob was second. This is fourth. The older brothers all discredit themselves in one way or another. Reuben, the oldest, sleeps with one of his father's concubines, so he's out. Levi and Simeon ruin the reputation of the whole family by the slaughter of the family of people that they believe had raped their sister. Judah ends up being the person of promise. But to catch the significance of this, we need to look at the story of the birth of those brothers. Genesis 29, verses 31 and following, a very short little story, tells us how when God saw that Jacob loved Rachel and did not love Leah, he closed Rachel's womb, but Leah began to bear children. He opened Leah's womb. Now Leah knew she was not the loved wife, but she bore a son first to her husband and figured this would probably help. So she named the child Reuben. Meaning, he's taken notice of my plight and done something about it. And yet, Jacob did not love her for giving his son. So, then a second son is born, Shimeon, which means he has heard. God has heard about my situation and given me this second son. Now my husband will love me. But Jacob did not love her. A third son is born, and we all know that the third time always works. And she is absolutely certain of that. So she names this child Levi, which means twisted around, intertwined, tied up together. Because the third son means my husband and I are now entwined forever. He has to love me. We have been tied. But still, he did not love her. Well, he didn't love her, but he kept getting her pregnant every year. And the fourth time, when she bears a child, the story says that she didn't even think about Jacob. The fourth time a child is born, she says, "This time I will simply thank God." So she named the child Yudah, which is the Hebrew for a gesture, actually. Which is the perfect gesture for her situation. I mean, trying to please this dude? But what are you supposed to do? But it's also the gesture, it's the word for giving thanks. Oh, give thanks. All those psalms that begin, oh, give thanks, that's the verb, yoda. Oh, give thanks to the Lord. Giving thanks in Hebrew is the gesture of throwing things back to God. Here, God, catch. Thank you, thank you, thank you. It's what we do at funerals. It's what we do when we give up and we don't have any way to fix what's wrong. It's all yours, God. I mean, it's a really multiform thing. That's Judah, for whom the people of Israel will forever after be named. The Jews, the Judeans, the people of thankfulness. And what if all the families of the earth could learn that you can't earn love, even with the fruit of your body, the most precious thing there is. That the response to everything is better off handing it back to God, whether in thankfulness or in Leah's frustration that nothing works. It's the surrender of thankfulness and gratitude. If the human family could learn that, wouldn't that be a blessing? Well, that's some of the riches of all that. Eventually, Israel becomes a great nation, but oddly enough, while enslaved in Egypt. They are still a little tiny group of nomads, a few dozen people until they get over the course of several centuries of slavery for many people in Israel. And then they come out. Countless times they nearly perish despite their size in the wilderness and so forth. And for the whole rest of the story, I have to hurry now here, hit and run theology for the next few minutes. God cannot let go and Israel cannot let go. And we have countless pieces of the tradition that are that little scenario at work. In the wilderness, Moses knows very well that God can't give up on this people, just like the people can't really give up on God. So you get wonderful little speeches like the talk between God and Moses in Exodus 32 when the people have done the golden calf thing. And Moses and God, I mean, God calls Moses up there and says, "Did you see what happened? Step back, Moses. I'm going to fry those people with my hot breath. This is terrible. But I don't want to kill you in the process. So you stand back. I'm going to start over. I'll make you a great nation. But these people, no way." And Moses says, wait. "You promised those people something. And if you kill them now, the Egyptians are going to say, look at that. Look what he did. You can push his buttons, and he'll do that. Do you want the neighbors talking like that?" And God says, "You're right. I think I won't do that. But you go down there and you tell them to cut that out." And then, of course, Moses goes down there. It's a crazy story. God forgives, but he can't. All kinds of trouble ensues. But anyway, over and over again, we get this. The whole book of Psalms is full of psalms of lament where this is how people talk to God. "I know you can't give up on me, God. It looks like you have, but you can't because you promised. And if you don't fulfill your promises to me or to us as your people, the neighbors will talk. And you cannot abide that. So do something about it, and man, are we going to praise you when you do do something about it, and you love that, we know. Smell that smoke. You liked it. You know, so God and Israel have this, I mean, they're tied together. They cannot let go of each other. Each is the other's last hope, the only thing each other has. You know, and you know, I got a whole bunch of texts here that illustrate this, and we just don't have time for all of them. Ezekiel 36 is one of my favorites, where God says to the people who have gone into exile, you made my name look terrible by what you made me do. Look what you made me do. With all your abominations and sins, you made me have to throw you out of your land. And there, that's the way you destroyed my reputation. You made me look like a common, ordinary God. Well, what is God's reputation? God's reputation, well, you know, God goes around boasting, I am gracious and merciful, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love. I even repent of evil that I threaten to do. That's the reputation. I love going around saying about myself. And you made me throw you out. And so now I look like somebody who's not gracious and merciful and slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and repents of the evil. My reputation is wrecked. And you did it. So I don't have any choice but to save your sorry hides one more time and get you out of here and clean you back up and give you a new heart and start over. But it's not because of you I'm doing this. I don't know if you like that part of this theology. God is really ticked when God says this. I don't have any choice. I just have to save you again because my reputation is at stake and I have to live up to my name. So I'm saving you. We still play upon this very thing when we pray in the Our Father, hallowed be thy name. We are praying a phrase out of Ezekiel 36. Make your name holy, God. Clean up your reputation, God, one more time. In fact, do it once and for all. That's what we're praying in that piece of the Our Father. Save us, God, despite ourselves. Make your name great. It's all anchored in the promise of God. That God links God's name with this name of Israel that will be great in the world and will be a blessing to all the families of the earth. Well, we better get to the New Testament for 5 minutes. A little time for rejoinders, discussion, or whatever. I think if you listen to a lot of explanations of how Christianity relates to this tradition we've just been rehearsing. I mean, I know I thought this as a kid. I didn't try to figure it out until it started to bother me. But you know, it on the surface, it sounds like God was going along with this thing with the Jews, and everything was going just fine. But then for some reason, all of a sudden, God just switched the rules and said, okay, it's not about being Jews anymore. Now I sent my son into the world, and I changed the password. And if you don't switch and use the new password, you're screwed. So forget all the old stuff. Now it's believing in Jesus, and the Jews are said to have gone, what? I don't think so. We're sticking with the old password. So all the Gentiles picked up the new password, and they started typing in J-E-S-U-S, when they walked in. And they got it, and they got in on all the new stuff, and the Jews are left behind, and that's the so-called supersessionist view of Christianity and Judaism. That the old covenant is out, the new covenant is in, and unfortunately the Jews said, no, we like the old password better. But of course, they don't get in on all the new programs. Can you believe in a God who would do that? Who would all of a sudden one day say, you know, all this faithfulness stuff to you people has been fun, but I've decided on a new game. I'm switching the password. We're going to try something different. Well, this is precisely the way it must have looked to some people in the very earliest times of Christianity. And Paul addresses an issue more or less like this. I've caricatured it some. But in the letter to the Romans, Paul is writing to some people who he wants to promise. And what he's promising them is the thing that Eric was reading in Matins this morning up in the dining hall. This remarkable promise of God that all of us cling to. We read this over and over at Christian funerals or when something terrible has happened. The promises of God in Romans chapter 8, in which Paul says, look, nothing can separate you from the love of God. Nothing whatsoever. In fact, he says, you have been predestined. God has had God's hands on you forever, from the beginning. Nothing can pluck you from God's hand. Trust that. Trust that God will always cling to you, even when you can't cling to God. But somebody could always say, yeah, you know, I used to think that, but then I heard about the Jews. I heard about the Jews to whom God made some really strong promises. And then all of a sudden God decided, nope, new password, moving on. Does that work? Well, in Romans 9 to 11, Paul addresses in great depth the problem of the fact that the gospel has come in Jesus Christ and the Jews have said no thanks. And what about them? What's to become of them, the people of the promise? Well, in verses 1 to 5 of Romans 9, Paul begins by saying one of those things that you almost say, man, an apostle of Jesus or anybody else shouldn't say that. Paul says, I would be willing to give up my eternal salvation if only this split wouldn't have happened. If only we could have kept this together. That the followers of Jesus, the people of Israel, could have stuck it out together. I'd give my eternal life. But it didn't happen. By Paul's time already, the fracture was bad enough that it was never going to be healed. So then, in the rest of chapter 9, Paul rehearses the long story of Israel's history, told as the story of God trying to have mercy on everyone, bringing blessing to all the families of the earth, but mostly everybody in the whole world saying, no thanks, I think we can handle it ourselves. Nice try, God, but we can do this. Or, as Paul would say, by the law. Chapter 10, Paul describes Christ as the end of the law. Although some have trusted in the promise of mercy, some haven't, though God seeks to save everyone. And Israel has stumbled over this scandalous message, Paul writes. But then in chapter 11, he explains that Israel has stumbled partly, at least, by God's own mercy. So that Gentiles may have a chance to get in on these promises. But then Paul asks the big question, does this mean that Israel is out, rejected, or damned? And then in Romans 11, verses 28 and following, Paul says this, and I'm going to read this quickly. As regards the gospel, they are enemies of God for your sake, but as regards election, they are beloved for the sake of their ancestors. For the gifts and the calling of God are irrevocable. Just as you were once disobedient to God, but have now received mercy because of their disobedience, so they have now been disobedient in order that by the mercy shown to you, they too may now receive mercy. For God has imprisoned all in disobedience so that he may be merciful to all. And then Paul breaks into song because he doesn't know what else to do. We can say beyond that point is, I don't understand it any better than you do, but let's sing. You know, what Paul is saying is, I promised you God would never let go of you. And you're thinking about a people that you think God let go of. I'm here to tell you, God wouldn't let them go any more than God would let you go. Because if God lets go of anybody, none of you can trust God, period. So don't ever think God lets Israel go. Ever. For any reason. Because God made a promise. And God will keep it. And you trust that about yourself. You may let go, but God will count on it. And this is the doctrine of predestination. When God gets hold of you, God never lets go. But notice, please, and here we're into theology that we don't have time for. Paul never says the alternative. He doesn't do the double predestination thing. There is no such thing in this theology. It's logical, but it's not there. Instead, we just sing about the fact that God makes promises and will keep them, and it's not logical, but we trust it. Oh, mercy, there's only 2 minutes left. I've done it again. Talked all the way to the end. Questions? Comments? I mean, Israel is the sign of God's trustworthiness. That's what Paul wants to teach us. And that's also, and there's a way in which that's the whole story of the Old Testament in a nutshell, is God's trustworthiness played out in relationship to a flesh and blood. Questions, comments? Shall we sing?